Eric Davila is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Davila to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host attorney Jack Lee filling in for Ray Hill, with additional criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The execution watch for Eric Davila begins.
This is Execution Watch. We're looking at the case of Eric Davila. It brings us no joy to do any of this, but every time Texas decides to execute somebody, we give you the legal case and we talk about it so that everyone has a better idea of exactly what's going on. Meanwhile, let's go talk to Linda in Huntsville. Let's go to Linda in Huntsville, please.
Hi, Jack. It's Linda.
Hi, Linda. How are you? Tell me what's going on in Huntsville. Have they crossed the street yet?
They have not crossed the street. They have not come out yet. So I guess it's just going to be a matter of minutes.
Well, let's see. I do know that the Supreme Court has denied his final appeal, so it doesn't look like he's got anything else. Davila has anything else coming up. Keep us posted, Linda. Thank you.
I'll call you back.
All right.
Jack? This is Bob Gartner, your engineer for tonight.
Yes.
I just want to say that Arab Voices, which is normally on at this hour, has been preempted this week. So for all you listeners who were counting on Arab Voices, please tune in same time next week.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob. All right. So we're talking about the case of Eric Davila. He was sentenced to capital murder in 2009. I'll just run over the facts, and then I'll switch over to Mike, who will give us some of his thoughts, then Larry, and then we'll finish up with Paige. All right. So on April 6, 2008, Eric Davila and Garfield Thompson, they are two gang members in Fort Worth, with the Bloods gang. They passed by in front of a person's house, Annette Stevenson, passed by her house several times, and at which point Eric Davila gets out of his car, and he goes across the street, goes into the shadows across the street, and then with a semi-automatic rifle with a laser dot, starts shooting the place up. He starts shooting up a children's birthday party. It was a Hannah Montana theme, and I want to tell you that idea, the Hannah Montana theme, just to give you an idea that this was a children's birthday party that he was shooting up. And if we have an idea, and it was a nine-year-old girl's birthday party. He supposedly was going after a guy named Jerry, who was a Crip, but instead he ended up shooting and killing the grandmother, Annette Stevenson, who was 40, and
younger sister, and
a granddaughter.
Yeah, the younger sister of the birthday girl.
Okay, hold on. Looks like we've got Linda. Linda, what do you have for me? Linda, what do you have for me? Are you there?
Yes, the witness is just crossed.
Okay. For those of you who are listening, when they cross the street, that means that the execution is taking place. When the witnesses cross the street, they'll eventually let the family as soon as the execution is done, they allow the families to come into the chambers after he's been laid out, so that they can touch his warm body for the last time. All right, Linda, is there anything else that you want to tell us?
No, everything's quiet out here. There's been no disturbances or anything. Everything's quiet.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. So getting back to the facts, so you've got
he
5-year-old granddaughter.
He kills the grandmother.
Annette Stevenson.
And the 5-year-old granddaughter.
As well.
Who is the sister of the birthday girl.
Correct. Eric Davila was seen by Cash Monet, another granddaughter of Annette Stevenson, who clearly identified him in a lineup afterwards. So they go to trial and they find him guilty of the murders. And during the punishment phase, a lot of witnesses come out and start a lot of evidence, facts come out regarding his propensity for violence. But more on that later. Let's, Mike, would you mind talking about adding to this case here?
Jack, you asked me to look into the motion to accuse the judge and the DA's office. So let's get a little bit of history. It seems like the judge in this case was a judge named Wilson. There were lots of arguments that Judge Wilson made this a capital case when it shouldn't have been. It was a capital case because it was more than one killings. The argument in the appellate level is that he didn't mean to kill more than one person. He was trying to kill one and more than one died. The evidence showed he was just shooting everybody up there with no regard to who he was shooting. The judge ruled it was a capital case because more than two people died. The interesting thing is that by the time it went to the appellate courts, the judge in that case, who made the decision it was capital, which is the reason he's being executed tonight, ends up being elected the DA of that county. So now that judge, who made the decision that this is a capital case, has got to be in charge of the appeal. Is that a conflict of interest? It's interesting. But the appellate courts ruled that as the role of a DA in appeal, the only role that that person has is a ministerial duty to set an execution date. They don't have duties to argue. They don't have duties to brief. They only have a duty to set an execution date. Now, the fact that their subservience, the people that work for them, are the ones handling the appeal, I'm not sure how that works. But they're saying that she's not going to have a conflict because she was not involved in the case. More bothersome, though, is that he had an appellate lawyer who was his appellate lawyer, probably court-appointed during his appeal. Now, during this part of the appeal, that appellate lawyer now also works for the county who's executing him. So the question becomes is, can his own lawyer end up being on the team that's executing him? To me, that's a strong issue for conflict of interest. They've overcome that by saying that the policies of that office, and understand, in a place like this county, either you're a defense attorney or you're a prosecuting attorney, and sometimes you do a little bit of both. It's not always a scenario where you've got the right to pick and choose your jobs. The fact that he was a court-appointed appellate lawyer for this case, does that make him ineligible to be a prosecutor prosecuting him? I think it does. They obviously thought it did, too, because they made a point of isolating him away from the case. What Ms. Wilson said as a DA is that we anticipated this problem, and so we isolated his prior lawyer from this case, so we have nothing to do with it.
Now, Mike, what would have happened if he had been recused and he had to remove himself? Would it have been the entire Tarrant County DA's office that would have had to remove themselves?
the question becomes is how much contact did he have in the case? How much talking did he do in the case? And that's something which we'll never know. What you don't be doing in a case like that is you wall off that employee from the case, in which there's instruction given the office that people can't discuss it or talk about it in their presence. But as we all know, that's almost impossible to do in an office like that. Everybody's going to know what happens. I don't think that... Is it a conflict? Yes. Is it really a conflict? We have no facts to show it. The fact that he was his defense attorney and now he becomes...
Well, his appellate attorney.
Excuse me, he was the appellate right. defense attorney and now he's on the state side is bothersome. But nobody's pointed out anything he did wrong. Nobody pointed out anything that he released. And let's say, for example, if he knew from talking to his client certain things about the client's behavior. Small things.
Right.
Could that be something he could tell people in his office to make them influenced on how to handle the case?
Now, Mike, do you think that it would make a difference if he had been a trial, if he had been the trial attorney?
I think as a trial attorney, it could have been a much more important difference because then you're involved with the facts of the case. The appellate lawyer is involved with the law of the case. When you're involved with the facts of the case, you by nature have got to talk to your client about many, many things, and you never know what he said or what he didn't say. When you're talking to a client getting ready for trial, you could be talking about his childhood, his high school days, other crimes he committed. You could talk about all kinds of things. Obviously, you have more information coming your way. When you're a appellate lawyer, you're dealing with the law. I just think the whole thing doesn't pass the smell test. When you're on both sides of the fence, It seems to be the simple thing to do is during the pendency of that case, he doesn't work for the district attorney's office.
Right.
They can put him someplace else.
Okay.
The other thing to do is move the whole case out of county. If that judge is now the DA, I don't know, procedurally, can they move it to another county for the appeal? I don't know.
It would probably be difficult and expensive. Now, you touched on something that I wanted to that I'd like you to develop a little bit more. You were this distinction between the capital murder that was executable where he can be executed and not. Would you discuss that for a little bit?
What I don't understand is that I had very similar fact scenarios in one of my cases. Man went back to a party with a rifle. He got in a tree.
Mike, if I could, tell me what the facts are in this case, and then
we
can talk
about it.
Well,
in this case, it's the same. He came back to a party he was unhappy about. He was unhappy that he was kicked out. And when he came back to the party, he came back and he wanted to kill one person. But when he went to kill that one person, he mentioned the name of the man he wanted to kill. He also mentioned that they were all sitting on the porch and he just shot them all up. The question is, did he intend to kill just that one and not more? His own testimony hurt him for that. His own testimony basically says he shot at everybody. Do I think he intended to kill more than one person? I don't think so.
Tell me about the law of what happens if you only intend to shoot one person and, say, miss and shoot a bunch of other people.
It's got to do with your intent.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, the problem is if you intended to fire the gun... You intended to fire the gun.
So what you're telling me is that if you intend to shoot one person, but you end up shooting five or six other people and killing them, that even though if your intent was only to one person and you're just a really bad shot, then you can't be executed.
You intended to press the full trigger.
Okay. All right. Larry, there was an issue regarding the withholding of evidence, that there were conflicting executions, basically that Davila says he was intoxicated, that he might as well have been – he was so intoxicated he might as well have been insane. Could you tell us more about this defense that he's saying that the state was withheld evidence?
Right, Mike. Jack. The whole issue, the claim is that the evidence was withheld. Now, you don't have to go a whole lot further than to claim that the evidence was withheld
right.
to try to say the state did something bad. That is, you withheld evidence. Now, you're not going to go forward and say, hey, had I had that evidence, you might make the claim, but had I had that evidence, I would have
sure.
done something with it, because chances are they would not have.
Right.
This is a capital murder. It's the circumstances are pretty bad, and the evidence against Davila was overwhelming, especially when you consider the fact that he gave four different statements.
Four different statements over 7 hours.
Over 7 hours. Okay. And you complain about it. You can complain about a lot of things, but, you know, he was given his warnings, and he gave, well, they take statements from you. But once the statement is taken, it's never referred to as a statement, it's a confession.
Right.
He confessed. And there seemed to be some evidence of a grudge that he had against
Jerry,
whose name he didn't know other than just the fat dude. So he sees the fat dude. Well, he borrows his girlfriend's car. He and his buddy then go out. He sees the fat dude on the porch. Okay, along with a bunch of other people. This is 8 o'clock at night. So he, as you mentioned, he hides in the shadows across the street, and he starts shooting the place up. He's trying to shoot the fat dude.
What was the term that he used? I forget.
I think was it was shoot him up.
He was looking for, he and Thompson were looking for a shoot him up.
A shoot him up, okay. So now, he intended to shoot Jerry.
Right.
Okay, and so the Jerry's mother and Jerry's daughter were both killed. Okay, in fact, he said I was shooting Jerry and the other dudes on the porch. And
of course, he couldn't identify which dude that was.
Because there were no other dudes.
There were no other dudes. Yeah, it was all women and children, except for Jerry.
But it raises the issue of intent.
Right.
Okay, and as Mike has already mentioned, you know, the whole, he intended to shoot the gun and to kill somebody.
Right.
Okay. So that intent that he had can be, under the law, transferred to the people who he actually killed. So he actually killed two people in one episode. Now, in capital murder cases, you get a lot of arguments that might not be made in other cases because the lawyers are trying to save this man's life.
Sure.
So the whole issue of the prosecutor's failure to disclose evidence of his voluntary intoxication. Now, voluntary intoxication is no defense.
It never is.
But it can support a claim of failure to disclose. So the issue is not, hey, I would have done this. It's just a matter of you failed to disclose. So because you did something bad, I ought to be able to
walk
somehow
away, right.
Reduce the case. Somehow I might be able to get my life saved.
Right.
But if that had been disclosed, the fact is, in any kind of case, including a capital, especially a capital murder case, lawyers know that evidence oftentimes cuts both ways. And so if you're trying to save his life, then you know, evidence that you take a gun and you then voluntarily go and get intoxicated and you then go out and kill people doesn't suggest that maybe we ought to save this person, because you're looking at two things for the issue of do we kill him or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that is future dangerousness. Okay, and mitigation. So
right.
On the future danger, Davila pretty much laid future danger out by himself.
Tell me about that. Tell me about the future danger,
well,
dangerousness in punishment.
He killed two people in one episode.
Right.
Okay, and a couple of days before he was
a person of interest, right?
On another murder, he already had a conviction, and he was a fairly young man. Okay, he already had a conviction for a burglary of a habitation, I believe.
At 19.
Correct.
And while he was in custody, because when we say future dangerousness, we try to limit that to saying, well, if you put him in prison forever, for the balance of his life, if you give him life in prison, then he's not going to be a danger to society. But the prosecutors point out, well, you know, society is not just people who are walking around the streets. Society is people in jail, including fellow inmates and security officials. So while he was in jail awaiting trial, he attempted to escape. And as a result of the escape, two other inmates were injured and security officials were injured.
Right, two prison guards, I believe.
So that really mitigate that's really an evidence of future danger to him. Okay, and the other thing about the future danger and mitigation issue is that, you know, there were some terrible things in his past, and we try to use that as much as we can. I mean, mm-hmm. the fact is, you know, his mother was a teenage mother.
I believe she was like 14 when 13. He was born. 13 or 14 when he was
she
born.
She was 14 when he was born. She'd been raped by her father's friend.
Well, now that's what his mother told him.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Admittedly, that's something that
We don't have any evidence about that.
And this same mother was a terrible mother to both her children, to the two Eric and his sister. But we don't have any evidence of his sister going out killing anybody.
Yeah,
okay?
But Larry, that could be mitigation evidence simply because it is his theory of his life. And so since it's his theory of his life, he plays into the theory that is given to him.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, so much cuts both ways. And so if we are talking about, here's a man who says, I'm trying to save my life, and I'm pointing out something that the prosecutor did, that is, going back to the original, failure to disclose. Well, first of all, that was a contested issue. The prosecutor said, we gave you everything.
Right.
And failure to disclose. Well, what do you mean failure to disclose? I mean, after all, if you were intoxicated, you could have told your lawyer yourself if you wanted to use that. But the prosecutor says, look, we gave you everything we had. And a lot of prosecutors will just say, look, you know what? We've got an open file policy anyway. We gave you everything we had. And so it was an issue that was raised in an effort, as so many efforts are in these kinds of cases, to save his life.
It's the kitchen sink. You might as well throw the kitchen sink at it because we're trying to save his life.
And had they disclosed, well, because apparently they did, the prosecutor apparently, well, their position was, we gave it to you. It was a contested issue as to whether they did in fact disclose. But even if that disclosure were not an issue, what would they have done with the evidence that he was voluntarily intoxicated at the time, such that it would raise the issue, and the argument was, it would raise the issue whether he had the requisite level of sanity to commit the offense. Well, you know, that again, like so many arguments, cuts both ways.
Right.
If that rendered you so insane, you know, do we really want people walking around who will voluntarily get so insane that they render themselves criminal?
Well, I think
it was the facts of the case are pretty terrible, and these lawyers,
they did the best
they could. Did an excellent job mm-hmm. of raising issue, but unfortunately for him, it was not successful.
I think you're exactly right that, you know, there, if we look at this case, there are so few issues of substance, of either legal substance or of appealable, factual appealability, that it's so obvious to us as lawyers that the trial attorneys did their job. They did their job right. And Larry, I think I completely agree with you. The facts here are just awful. You have a 19-year-old, for lack of better words, 19-year-old kid who decides to shoot up a Hannah Montana birthday party.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, if that, you know, this kind of a crime, this kind of a shooting is exactly what inflames people. That, and I think, you know, you touch on something. Larry, I wanted to point out what, something that you mentioned earlier, this voluntary intoxication. You know, voluntary intoxication, I believe he said he was on ecstasy, he was on PCP. You know, you did that to yourself. And if you did that to yourself, we don't like to excuse people for behaviors that they voluntarily undertake.
Which is exactly why there was not a whole lot of the press, the effort was not to say, hey, had I gotten this, I would have been able to use it necessarily. I mean,
right.
You pay lip service to that.
Sure.
But the primary point is, prosecutor, you failed to give it to me, and you've got that affirmative duty to provide that to me. So the argument was not so much that this is so great. I mean, you make that issue.
Sure.
This is so great that it would have exonerated me. It was more focusing on the prosecutor's failure. And so when you're trying to save the life, it's a matter of you look at who failed what. And there were several issues that were raised on the appellate
mm-hmm.
process.
Sure.
That the evidence was insufficient. Okay. That the attorneys all along were ineffective, that his written confessions should not have been admitted. You raise those issues. Okay. That the death penalty statute itself is unconstitutional.
Wrong.
You raise that issue. And that the trial court then erroneously instructed the jury on the proof on mitigation. These
that
are
was
fine
it, right.
points that you just raise and raise and raise. But when you get back to the facts of the case and the two primary issues that are to be discussed, the balancing test.
Right.
That is future danger and mitigation. Those are the two counterbalancing forces that we as a society use in determining whether a person deserves to be put to death. First of all, is he death eligible? He gets there by having committed two murders in the same episode. And then the second issue is, do we kill him? Does the future danger issue outweigh the mitigation? And in this case, it appears that the triers of fact had decided all along
right.
that it did not.
Well, I mean, and you know, can you imagine at so? Let me for the listeners who don't know, you have in any kind of a capital murder, capital punishment case, you have two phases. Your first phase is the guilt innocent. Did he or didn't he do it? And then once the jury comes back with yes, he did, then you go into the punishment phase. And in the punishment phase, they talk. The lawyers come up. The state says you need to get rid of him. He needs to die because he's going to be a future danger, and you can't let somebody out. Have somebody in prison because he's going to be such a danger to the prison population. To you know, in the event he escapes, so on and so forth. The defense will come out and say, well, you know. He's not going to be a future danger. He's, you know, there are certain circumstances where it's not going to happen, and these are, and look at his bad childhood and things like that. And this goes back to exactly what Larry was talking about. It cuts both ways. If he had a bad childhood, that just because he's in prison doesn't mean that bad childhood that caused him to be extremely violent disappears. It's not like, you know, many of the things that might come across as mitigation evidence. We might think of as mitigation evidence. Well, he's
would tend to be inculpatory in front of
exactly
a jury.
That's exactly right. And to a large extent, what ends up happening is by the time the jury finds you guilty, they already don't like you. And if they don't like you, they
mitigation probably doesn't have a leg to stand on.
It would be very, very difficult for mitigation to actually work.
But even in this case, Jack, finding him guilty of capital murder for having killed two people in the same episode, the evidence was fairly convincing, clearly convincing. The punishment evidence, where the state, which they can bring up, you know, not just convictions but any bad acts. But in his case, when you consider murder, aggravated,
he had a burglary habitation, bird cap.
But he's supposed to commit an aggravated robbery.
Oh, did
and a murder 2 days before he had a conviction for burglary habitation.
Mm-hmm.
We try our best here at KPFT to try to explain. These matters in a manner that people might not get other places, and we are, you know, we're down the middle here. We try to call them as we see them, with sympathies on both sides. This is a tragic case on both sides.
Oh, this is absolutely terrible.
When you consider, you know, you describe this as a Hannah Montana type party, but you know this is 8 o'clock at night. Okay, and
it's a family event.
It's a family event, but you know they're still out at 8 o'clock at night, and the young man who he was trying to
Jerry.
Okay, the claim was, Davila's claim was that Jerry was, Davila's a blood, that Jerry was a Crip. Jerry says, I wasn't a Crip, but I did break up a fight between Davila and others,
right.
and my family members right here at this place. So he knew where he was going. Okay, and he went apparently to avenge whatever happened between him and Jerry.
Some slight.
Who he didn't know other than the fat dude on the porch.
Yeah, and as a 19-year-old, he was focused in on the idea that he was going to avenge himself and get back at him without thought of what the repercussions could have been, with no thought of repercussions.
You know, frankly, on a lot of these crimes, and frankly, most crimes generally, if you just look at it and say, you know what, I'm just going to walk away from it. Nothing ever happens. Your ego gets
a little bruised,
but you walk away, and you don't go to prison. You don't get executed. Something that you said about these lawyers, I think they did do everything they could have possibly done, and I think this. I think that you touched on it. I think the not bringing up intoxication. Either in during the trial or as mitigation in guilt innocence or as mitigation evidence. My best guess is, and you know, I don't want to play too much into trying to second guess what the trial attorneys did, but I'm thinking that that was probably done strategically.
Or rather
tactically.
You're assuming that they knew that underlying fact, and they might have,
mm-hmm.
but if they did, okay. And they brought it up, the trial lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to be too skeptical or about the whole matter, but I would suspect that if they brought up the voluntary intoxication, which is not a defense, I would suspect that an appellate lawyer might declare that to be ineffective assistance of counsel.
Oh.
Speaking
of ineffective assistance of counsel, Paige, could you talk about that for me?
Oh, well, there were many claims of ineffective assistance of counsel in this because he has gone through the automatic appeal. Well, he has gone through the trial in Fort Worth. Then he has the automatic appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And then there is the habeas process in the state courts. And then the federal habeas process begins. And so ineffective assistance of counsel came up in the Fort Worth issue as a result of his behavior on the stand at punishment and whether or not they thought that his punishment testimony was beneficial or punitive. And the truth of the matter is, as we have discussed before, it truly felt from reading the case, since, of course, I did not see it when it happened. I'm just reading about it. But it really felt from reading the case on direct appeal that it was so over at the end of guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no way that mitigation evidence was going to come into play because at this point in the punishment phase, we get the state is allowed to present evidence of his future dangerousness and violence and the violence that immediately preceded this murder and the murder that we were talking about that was committed 2 days before this one. Which he was not charged with.
They didn't need it.
The Fort Worth District Court didn't need it. They already had this one, and this one was a 9-year-old. A 5-year-old and a 40-year-old grandmother that had nothing to do with the Bloods or the Crips. And they were celebrating the sister's birthday, along with a bunch of people from the neighborhood. And all of these people were children or women, aside from the one uncle that was attending the party.
The father,
yes.
Jerry, of Cash Monet.
Yes, indeed.
Right. Who, Cash Monet is the 11-year-old who identified Davila.
Yes.
Jack,
Larry?
Ray's not here today, but I know one of the things he likes to point out is that we very seldom execute people who committed the crime. Davila is 10 years older than he was when this offense was committed.
That's right.
Okay, this apparently occurred in April of 2008. This is 2018. And when you put a person in prison for the length of time he's been there, now, yes, he did try to attempt to escape while the trial was pending, but you know he's still a young man, okay? He's still a young man, but you know we do need to consider, and this is not a legal issue or anything. It's just when we consider ourselves a society, you know, what are we doing? I mean, he did commit a horrendous act, but you know what purpose? We have to ask ourselves what purpose are we really serving by putting him to death without at least considering, you know, where is he now? Where is his head now?
Well,
and can he? Is it really necessary? Do we, or are we just extracting vengeance? That's the question we
sure.
As a society
well,
have to ask
you
ourselves.
Mean the sociological and the psychological perspectives
yes.
on the death penalty
yes.
as it affects somebody who is now 31 years old as opposed to 20 years old at the time this occurred.
And also giving due deference to the people who lost their loved ones. I mean, we've got to consider them too, but it's just something that I believe that, you know, Ray points this out on a regular basis.
That he does.
And it's something,
that he does.
Something
that
we
thanks
need,
for pointing
we,
that
we
out.
Need to consider.
Since Ray is not here, thanks for speaking on his behalf.
Ray is I understand, presiding over a
Houston Media Source, board. He is the chairman of the Houston Media Source
sure.
board.
Okay.
You know, I was visiting during a on January 2nd. I was at a parole hearing, and the board member there, very nice gentleman. He said something that I thought was that really I thought was poignant. Not everyone in prison. I'm sorry, Bob. Okay. All right. Linda called and said that the witnesses have crossed the road the other way and the execution is over. Eric Davila is no longer alive. Now his body is being prepped so that his family members can touch his warm body for one last time. This is a morbid thing that the state of Texas does. It is, whether you agree with it or not, it is a fact that Eric Davila is dead.
We can conclude, though, that he, with the shortness of the time, that he did not suffer needlessly.
Yes. I mean, and there have been issues about capital punishment, especially throughout the United States, because drug manufacturers have precluded certain states that have capital punishment from receiving the drugs, the three-drug cocktail. And Texas has gone to a single drug.
That's correct.
Because we cannot outsource.
Reliably, yeah.
We cannot reliably outsource the other two drugs.
Back to what the parole board member said. Not everyone in prison is bad, and not everyone outside of prison is good. But everyone who started in prison, who is in prison, started out outside of prison. Do people? I think one of the questions that we, what is the purpose of our criminal justice system, and frankly, of executions? I think that's a relevant question to be asking. I remember having lunch with someone on the TDCJ board, and he said, "Look, the two purposes of TDCJ is I love you, and I hate you. I love you. I want to I want you to rehabilitate. I want you to do better. While you are being punished in prison, I want you to get better. Figure your life out so that and it's typically men, your young stupid man can learn to be a wise, not quite so young and not quite so stupid older man. And then there's the part that I hate you. You've done wrong by society, and therefore you must be punished. And because, frankly, our civilization wants a pound of flesh. It's a balancing act that, frankly, I don't envy the folks in the TDCJ system.
Well, and how much of that is also fear? The fear of society on the negative, from
sure.
the negative perspective, the fear of society and of the voters in general concerning the potential activities of people who cannot be trusted.
Sure.
And, it's very complicated to talk about capital punishment without referring to specific cases. It's very complicated to talk about capital punishment, period, because I don't believe that many people want to have anything personally to do with it. They don't want to be a victim. They don't want to be on a jury that is responsible for hearing about the facts where they might end up sentencing people. They don't want to be involved. And that fear and the trepidation about being involved causes our complicated view toward capital punishment.
I agree with you, and I think that's unfortunate. It is that, for lack of better words, that most people, most individuals, lack the courage to do the difficult intellectual and emotional heavy lifting. If we don't step up to that difficulty, we don't challenge it, we don't come face to face with it, we give up. We give up and we go for an easy solution, and the easy solution is never rational. When we confront it, we can get past our emotional discomfort. We can get past our emotional need for, say, vengeance. Or we can get past our emotional desire, our absolute emotional conviction that all life is sacred. Then we can actually, once we confront those emotions, once we confront those emotional issues, we can rationally work through, do the rational heavy lifting of working through whether what we're doing as a civilization is right or not right. And frankly, whether these rules that the four of us are dealing with, these rules on capital punishment, if they even make sense at all.
Which gets to my comment.
This is Mike Gillespie.
This is Fort Worth, Dallas. As I started saying before, I had the exact same fact situation in Harris County, except he wasn't high on drugs. He got thrown out of a party, he came back in the tree, and he aimed and killed multiple teenagers. Not only was it a capital case, the offer was 35 years. And the jury beat that case, gave him less than 35 years. He's out now. I want to say to Eric, who's dead, he shouldn't have done it up in Fort Worth. Why is it different penalties in different parts of the state? I don't understand it.
Mike, you want me to answer that?
Oh, I know the answer. I just don't understand it.
No, society is entirely different in Angleton than it is in Harris County.
Oh, goodness gracious, is it ever.
Society is different in Fort Worth than it is in Houston. And I am not holding out Houston residents as harbingers of great behavior. But as a general rule, Houstonians do accept a wider standard of behavior.
Sure. I think we tend to.
Than Tarrant County residents, I tend to think.
Well, we are the third largest metropolitan city in the U.S. If you have a tendency to be judgmental, you're not going to last very long. You're going to be a very unhappy person in Houston.
Well, and there are lots of unhappy people. We see them on juries all the time.
And different juries in different neighborhoods have got the right to come up with different conclusions.
Sure.
But whether or not the DA in Harris County should come up with a different conclusion than a DA in Arlington County, sometimes it's a question of the finance of the counties to avoid a capital case, and that should not be the factor of somebody getting life in prison or being executed.
Well, how much money the government has. Well, Mike, maybe there's the possibility that somebody will come up with a deep learning algorithm and standardize all of this.
I'd like to point out something that Mike likes to point out from time to time to make a point on this, and that is, back on April the 6th, 2008, Annette Stevenson and Keyshawn Stevenson died. They died at the hands of Eric Davila. It was a homicide. That's under the law is called capital murder, done by an individual. Today, April 25, 2018, Eric Davila is now dead. He died at the hands of the state of Texas. It's couched as a homicide and execution. When we, as a society, just need to decide, whether this is what we want to do. We can't do anything for Annette Stevenson nor Keyshawn Stevenson. But we did something as a society, and we're all involved in this,
mm-hmm. Okay? Sure.
Because we're all part of the society.
Oh, sure.
And so we just need to just always consider what are we, because we're all part of this. And so I know Mike likes to point this out, particularly the whole issue of it being a homicide, because he was killed by the state, by people.
Yes, because cause of death on Mr. Davila is homicide.
Homicide, absolutely.
It's homicide by the state of Texas, but it's homicide.
Nevertheless. Sure.
And when you say the state of Texas, we're all part of that.
Of course.
So I wanted to get back. So Eric Davila is dead. There was a last-minute appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court, which about 12 minutes before 6 o'clock, the U.S. Supreme Court denied any possibility of appeal. So at that point, the only way he could have been his execution might have been stayed is if the governor had stayed the execution. Under the circumstances, under the facts that we saw, that was highly, highly unlikely. At the beginning of the program, I made it a point to talk about that this was a children's birthday party for a 9-year-old, and that the victim was a 5-year-old granddaughter, and the other victim was a 40-year-old grandmother. These kinds of horrific crimes have a tendency to get people riled up. It has a tendency to get if there were a reason for an appeal, if there were a reason for a stay, these kinds of facts get people – it doesn't make people very sympathetic. And if – we look through the cases. The four attorneys here, Larry, Paige, Mike, myself, we all look through the cases. And honestly, there really wasn't a lot for us to sink our teeth into that we thought that was just – glaringly appealable. I think the trial attorneys did their job, and God bless the appellate attorneys. They had their work cut out for them.
They dug up issues.
They dug up all the issues they could, and frankly, there weren't many.
No, there were not.
No.
Another thing, though, that we do need to consider is that because this is a killing by the state, but we as a society here in America, we take it seriously.
Sure.
We
have
to. There are parts of the world where they don't go through as much as we go through here to make sure that we at least make the effort to get it
correct.
Right.
Correct.
So it's like, I guess it was Slaughterous People. I'm not sure which TV show it was. Say, democracy is a terrible system except all the,
Churchill.
All the rest is so much worse.
That's a quote from Churchill. Democracy is the worst form of government,
except
for all of the other forms of government.
Okay. So we in our self analysis, our self evaluation, we need to consider what we're doing, but we can't throw out all the systems. Because the systems are extremely important too.
I wanted to get back to something that Paige had brought up, and I think that's that we're uncomfortable. Everything about this whole about execution, on the one hand, makes us uncomfortable, and we just want to brush it away. We just want to get it done and just wash our hands and walk away. And I think that Paige is right. We need to step up. We need to go through the intellectual heavy lifting, the emotional heavy lifting, and figure out whether this is actually a rational thing that we should be doing, and if so, what can we do rationally that makes sense in the process?
Well, you know, we evolve as a society anyway. I mean, back in 2008, you know, we didn't have life without parole.
That's correct.
Now, if this case were tried under current law, what would the outcome be?
Probably life without parole.
I don't know. I quite frankly, but I
really don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
But I applaud the fact that we've evolved as a society, at least to make life without parole a possibility. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that he would have gotten life under even the current law.
Well, under the facts.
But the facts are pretty horrific. But at least now it's available. And so we can applaud ourselves, you know, not a lot, but we can applaud ourselves as a society that we have evolved to the point where at least we consider life without parole.
We're attempting like other avenues. Whether or not we're successful in finding them, that's another matter. But we are attempting other avenues. And, Jack, you know, the truth of the matter is I tend to think based upon his based upon Mr. Davila's behavior just prior to these murders,
right,
that he, even now, he probably would have received the same sentence. It's just he set out a pattern of behavior for himself that week that was inculpatory.
It was... He had a collision with destiny.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that destiny has ended today. Eric Davila is dead. The state of Texas has executed him. Not much more to it than that. So, do we have anything else that anyone else would like to discuss? I think we've talked a lot about the various issues in this case. It's actually difficult for me to get past how ugly this was. It was a children's birthday party. Mike?
It wasn't any uglier than Anthony Shore, who was a convicted murderer or rapist. We have people who killed and murdered people for sexual pleasure, to 20 and 30 people. If we call this guy bad, what do we call those people? This is a kid who did something stupid. This was a kid who got his feelings hurt in a fight, and he took a gun and he shot people. He should be punished for it. Should he be killed for it? I don't know. All I do know, if he's bad, where do we put the Anthony Shores of the world?
I don't have a good answer for that.
And by the way, I just read today
that a good answer for
after our show on Anthony Shore, after we went off the air, you remember he was trying to get to stay because he had more things he wanted to confess to? After we went off the air, he made big confessions to a bunch more murders and found bodies as he's dying. He went to peace, giving up the other bodies he killed. That's an evil person. Mm-hmm.
It's I don't have a good solution there, Mike. I don't know what to tell you.
I've got a solution.
Tell me.
The only purpose of the death penalty is a detriment to crime. Justice delayed is justice denied. When Johnny takes a gun and Johnny robs a store and Johnny gets killed, there's a chilling effect in the community. Johnny screwed up. But when Johnny gets arrested and Johnny goes to court and he gets executed 15, 20 years later, the system killed Johnny. The judge killed Johnny. If the purpose of a death penalty is a chilling effect on the community around, the next morning everybody says, Johnny screwed up. Johnny took a gun and he got killed. So that's the purpose of the death penalty. Anything else is just punishment.
So can we agree then that you subscribe to the Charles Barkley philosophy of the death penalty, that it shouldn't be the death penalty, it should be death week? When Charles Barkley was running for governor of Alabama, he said, "You know, if you elect me as governor, you know, there's not going to be the death row. There's going to be death week. If it's a deterrent. I mean, I get your point. If your purpose is deterrence, it's not the current system is not working.
Yeah, it's a chilling effect. The neighborhood saw Johnny yesterday. Then Johnny got a gun. Now Johnny's dead." Therefore, getting a gun will get you killed.
So where's the threshold then? Where's the threshold evidence by which you simply decide that you can go after somebody?
No, it's just if the store owner kills Johnny during the robbery, if the police get in a shootout, that's a chilling effect in a neighborhood. There's not a chilling effect when we assassinate somebody 20 years later.
But do we want everyone walking around with guns on their hips?
Sure.
Ah, okay. I don't, but...
I do.
That's fine.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Sorry.
It's food for thought. Food for thought. We'll think about that.
No.
All right. I can't. This is Execution Watch. It brings us no joy at all to whenever these events happen. Because it is, in fact, the state of Texas executing somebody. It's our civilization killing someone. It brings us no joy. It brings us no joy to talk about the legal case and the facts behind it because real people have died. And for better or for worse, Eric Davila is dead tonight by the hand of the state of Texas. I hope you'll join us next time for Execution Watch. Have a good night. Got a problem.